Our biblical text today is an extremely familiar one, more familiar historically even than the Christmas story. In the early church, it seems Christmas was not even celebrated in the first decades following Jesus' death. But every year, the story of Jesus' crucifixion, death, and resurrection was annually commemorated right from the start. But today I'd like to look at this very familiar story, Luke's account of the crucifixion, including the penitent thief on the cross beside Jesus, through a couple of particular lenses. One is the lens of it being Christ the King Sunday, last one before Advent each year in the church calendar. Second is the lens of memory, what it means to forget and to remember, particularly in the context of dementia. What does it mean for the thief to plead, "Jesus, remember me"? John Swinton has written the book Dementia, Living in the Memories of God, which received an award from the Archbishop of Canterbury. I just finished it this week. I highly recommend it. But at first, let's look at some main points from our text. The theme of Jesus' kingship is all through this passage, even if it doesn't seem to be very apparent to many of those involved in the story. First, there's the arrangement of the crosses. Verse 33, when they came to the place called the Skull, there they crucified him along with the criminals, one on his right, the other on his left. Jesus, as king, is given the central position, as if with his two attendants or aides on either side. Verse 36, the soldiers offered him wine vinegar. This is done mockingly. Perhaps they bow or kneel as they bring it forward, drawing a laugh from their buddies. But it's as if they are cupbearers to a sovereign lord. There are the texts referred to both of Scripture and the visible sign on the post above Jesus' head. Verse 35, they said he saved others, let him save himself if he is the Christ of God, the chosen one. These are scriptural titles, Messiah, chosen one, recalling prophecies from the Psalms, Isaiah, and elsewhere. There's a ring of Psalm 22:8. He trusts in the Lord. Let the Lord rescue him. Let him deliver him, since he delights in him. Israel looked for the coming Messiah or Christ who would be its triumphant king. From the Roman side, there's the sign Pilate had drawn up to label this particular criminal's offense as a warning or a deterrent to passers-by and onlookers. They often put these signs on to label what the person is crucified for. Verse 38, there was a written notice above him which read, "This is the King of the Jews." Of course, the Jewish leaders realized this was meant to be ironic, a joke at their expense, an insincere racist jibe. They tried to have Pilate modify it unsuccessfully. I think this morning, maybe modern day Pilate would be at the Ku Klux Klan, lynched a black person and then wrote about it, "Black Lives Matter." It's just a real jab at the whole race. But the point remains, that was the thrust of their accusation against Jesus to Pilate, by which they hoped to have him killed in the first place, this kingship. Luke 23:2, and they began to accuse him, saying, "We have found this man subverting our nation. He opposes payment of taxes to Caesar and claims to be Christ, a king." John records Pilate's opening question in his examination of the accused. John 18:33, Pilate summoned Jesus and asked him, "Are you the King of the Jews?" I guess this was kind of the key point. There's so much of this king emphasis that even the penitent thief picks up on it and uses the same terminology. Verse 42, and he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." Greek basileia, royal power, kingship, dominion, rule. This week, 600 New Yorkers did not want the label Trump Place to grace their buildings any longer. Trump had developed them years ago, but no longer owned them. So these hundreds of tenants petitioned successfully for the letters to be removed. They did not want to be associated with the newly elected president. Not unlike them, most of those gathered near Jesus' cross did not want him to be their leader. They rejected his label of king. They would prefer to forget him instead, to see him killed, gone. Verse 35, the people stood watching, and the rulers even sneered at him. Verse 36, the soldiers also came up and mocked him. Verse 39, one of the criminals who hung there hurled insults at him. Aren't you the Christ? Save yourself and us. The people stand in implicit consent. The rulers sneer, soldiers mock. Fellow condemned prisoner hurls insults. They can't forget him fast enough, it seems. The ones who should have known best who this person was, the religious leaders, had forgotten the scriptures that pointed towards his very coming. Acts 13:27. The people of Jerusalem and their rulers did not recognize Jesus. Yet in condemning him, they fulfilled the words of the prophets that are read every Sabbath. They forgot God's inspired promises about the deliverer he would send for them. They didn't recognize their king. He was stripped naked, not dressed in royal robes. He was hung on a rough cross, not seated on a marble throne. He was shouted at with insults and sneers rather than cheers and exclamations of praise. What kind of king is this? Here there is no victory march, no ticker tape parade, no procession as Roman generals commonly held coming back from a successful campaign with long lines of captives and slaves from the land they just subjugated. What kind of king can this be? Not one that fits our categories. A broken king. A crucified king. One who understands us humans in all our frailty, weakness, and brokenness, be that physical, mental, spiritual. As a believer looking back on those events, it all seems so ironic. Why didn't they recognize him? Couldn't they situate themselves in their surroundings, acknowledge the wonder of God's timing, how scriptures from Psalm 22 and Isaiah 53 were being fulfilled before their very eyes? In some senses, sin is spiritual dementia. The word dementia comes from a Latin word meaning out of one's mind. Those jeering at Jesus that day just couldn't put together what their eyes were seeing with the significance of their occasion. They didn't know what time it was. The kairos, or critical juncture in spiritual history, God was orchestrating. Sin in general is theological craziness. As supposed Christ followers, it's as if we've suddenly developed a severe case of amnesia. We forget who Jesus is. In the moment of committing deliberate sin, we choose to not acknowledge he really is Lord of our life. Paul writes of unbelieving Jews in 2 Corinthians 3:14 and 15. But their minds were made dull, for to this day the same veil remains when the old covenant is read. Even to this day when Moses is read, a veil covers their hearts. 4:4, the God of this age has blinded the minds of unbelievers so that they cannot see the light of the gospel of the glory of Christ, who is the image of God. Minds blinded. Minds made dull. Sin is spiritual dementia. Like a confused person wandering around not knowing where they are. When we're sinning, we're forgetting how to place ourselves in relation to God's sovereign position and claim on our lives. We're all crazy, mad, the onlookers, the rulers, the soldiers, that other criminal hurling insults. In this text, in the whole crowd of witnesses listed, there's only one truly sane person in the bunch besides Jesus. One person who recognizes the truth about the situation. One person who can get his bearings and orient himself accurately to the king who is right before him. Everybody else is lost, confused, but this man knows where he is, what's happening, and what he needs to do next before he draws his last breath. Verses 40 and 41. But the other criminal rebuked him. Don't you fear God, he said, since you're under the same sentence? We are punished justly, for we're getting what our deeds deserve. But this man has done nothing wrong. Now that's the truth. He recognizes Jesus' innocence as Pilate had done previously in verses 4, 15, 22. And Pilate implies King Herod as well had failed to find fault in Jesus. Verse 14, 15. I've examined him in your presence, Pilate says, and have found no basis for your charges against him. Neither has Herod, for he sent him back to us. As you can see, he has done nothing to deserve death. Three times, just in that couple of verses there, Pilate emphasizes Jesus' innocence. Everybody else was speaking untruth about Jesus. Slander, insults, mocking. Only this voice speaks the truth, identifies the reality of it all despite the smokescreen. This man has done nothing wrong. The tragic but true verdict is announced boldly, not by the religious leaders, but by a nobody, a condemned criminal. Yet it was the most significant truth of the day. An innocent man was being crucified on account of others. Isaiah 53:5. Let's read this together. But he was pierced for our transgressions. He was crushed for our iniquities. The punishment that brought us peace was upon him, and by his wounds we are healed. The penitent thief cries out to the battered, bloody, and half-dead form on the cross next to him, Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom. When, not if. That's solid faith, trusting something will happen without question. The man didn't have any good works to boast of or barter with as if they could earn his way into heaven. And Jesus accepted his simple trust. Verse 43, Jesus answered him, I tell you the truth, today you will be with me in paradise. Jesus, remember me. To be remembered by God is pretty special. It's unlike being remembered by another mortal. In Hebrew understanding, memory is always connected with the will, not simply with thought. When God remembers someone, it's with a view to take supportive action toward them, usually supportive action. Genesis 8:1. But God remembered Noah and all the wild animals and the livestock that were with him in the ark, and he sent a wind over the earth and the waters receded. Genesis 19:29. So when God destroyed the cities of the plain, he remembered Abraham and he brought Lot out of the catastrophe that overthrew the cities where Lot had lived. 30:22. Then God remembered Rachel. He listened to her and opened her womb. 1 Samuel 1:19, Elkanah lay with Hannah his wife, and the Lord remembered her. So in the course of time, Hannah conceived and gave birth to a son. Start to see the pattern here? God remembering leads to some action. And this is not a supportive one here. Revelation 16:19, the great city split into three parts, and the cities of the nations collapsed. And God remembered Babylon the Great and gave her the cup filled with the wine of the fury of his wrath. It's a different kind of remembering, but God's potent remembering. You see the connection. When God remembers someone, it's massively significant. Something's going to happen. But remembering is very active, has consequences or effect. Even when Jesus is undergoing severe agony, hanging on the cross, he remembers others with a view to saving action. Think about it. How many of us have been prompted to pray for those who are insulting and torturing us? Yeah. See how Jesus remembers others in verse 34. Jesus said, Father, forgive them, for they do not know what they are doing. Forgiveness is God remembering to forget. To forget all our sins and misdeeds. Isaiah 43:25. I am he who blots out your transgressions for my own sake and remembers your sins no more. Jeremiah 31:34. A very precious passage pointing from the old covenant into the new. No longer will a man teach his neighbor or a man his brother, saying, Know the Lord, because they will all know me, from the least of them to the greatest, declares the Lord. For I will forgive their wickedness and will remember their sins no more. aren't you glad that God remembers to have a poor memory when it comes to your trespasses? He says, I distinctly remember forgetting that. We may become anxious to pray, Jesus, remember me, especially as we get older. There are many things that can affect our mental capacity, from brain injuries to cancer to Alzheimer's. John Swinton, in his book on dementia, identifies a definite bias in our Western society, one that may make us especially apprehensive of losing our mental faculties. He cites Stephen Post, who observes, we live in a culture that is the child of rationalism and capitalism, so clarity of mind and economic productivity determine the value of human life. Post's term, hypercognition, we got three technical terms I'm teaching you today, so it's enhance your vocabulary a little bit. You say hypercognition?
Hypercognition.
There's one you can impress on your neighbors. Relates to the tendency within Western liberal cultures to isolate intellect, reason, and rationality, and identify these aspects of human beings as having particular moral and social significance. Thus, there's a distinct bias toward diseases which affect intellect and rationality. In his book, Swinton talks about a couple of traps we can fall into in relating to those suffering from dementia. One is malignant social psychology. Say psychology?
Psychology.
Okay, well, that's enough for now. This refers to social environments in which the forms of interpersonal interactions and communications that occur diminish the personhood of those people experiencing that environment. A simple example of malignant social psychology would be not thinking twice about talking about a person as if he or she were not there. He won't remember. She can't understand. He's not really the person he used to be, so. Similarly, we might find ourselves making comparisons between the individual with dementia and a child. She's just like a child. No, she's not. Similarly, we may belittle this person by ignoring her, by not consulting her about things that are important in her life, or by acting treacherously, by tricking her into situations for her own good. We're just going for a Sunday drive, we might say to her, when in fact we're taking her to a care home where she'll spend the rest of her life with strangers. Another trap to beware of is called malignant social positioning. Say positioning.
Positioning.
Positioning. So we've got the psychology, this one's this positioning. And positioning or placing someone in a social encounter in such a way as that their personhood is threatened. For example, there's a big difference between a woman introducing her husband to you by saying, this is my husband John, he has dementia, versus, this is John, my husband. In the former case, Swinton says, he has lost his multifaceted role as a functioning husband and has acquired a primary identity as someone who has dementia. A big point in this book is giving people the benefit of the doubt. Don't diminish someone's personhood by the way you introduce them or by the way you're treating them in that context. Swinton urges us to go beyond thinking of diseases like dementia as simply neurological or biological, the physical wiring aspect of it, if you will. There are important social and spiritual components as well. In fact, the social dynamic can negatively impact the person's neurological health. Examples we just gave there, if you're going to carry on a conversation as if that person weren't there, well, they're going to tune out because you're not involving them. So the way you interact in the midst of others is going to negatively impact their condition if that keeps up. Okay. The church has a role in helping those with dementia realize that they are remembered by God even when they no longer have their own faculty of memory. Swinton says, God's memory is for the purpose of remembering. To remember something is to bring back together that which has been fragmented. In terms of the redemption of humanity, to be remembered by God is to be reconstituted and brought back together, moved from a state of fragmentation to one of wholeness in God, or shalom. to be held and remembered by God implies some form of divine action toward the object of the memory. God acts in particular ways toward people because of a previous commitment. In other words, God remembers because God promises. God remembers God's chesed, God's great mercy and love. Psalm 25, 6 and 7. Remember, O Lord, your great mercy and love, for they are from of old. Often, music remains deep in the memory even after other cognitive ability has disappeared. For example, the elderly woman who can't put a sentence together, but still plays the piano beautifully and can even transpose on the fly. Somehow it seems like the memory is in her hands, if that were possible. When the community of God's people gather to worship, then our collective memory in singing songs together can become a powerful means of including those with dementia as they find they too can actually participate in the worship experience. They may not be able to carry on a conversation with you, but you find them sing along that old hymn. An example, Swinton refers to neurologist Oliver Sacks, who tells of Jimmy, a former sailor whose memory had been destroyed by Korsakoff's syndrome. That's often linked to alcohol abuse. Jimmy, this former sailor, could remember things prior to 1945, but nothing since. They had been talking for 20 minutes or so when Sacks left the room briefly. When he returned, Jimmy seemed surprised to see him. In a matter of seconds, his conversation with Sacks had disappeared from his memory, and he was starting his encounter with Sacks all over again. Sacks described Jimmy as de-souled. The disease had, he thought, stripped Jimmy of something essential to what he was as a human being. From a neurological perspective, Sacks felt that the person Jimmy had been had gone. His soul had gone. But those close to Jimmy saw something different. One of the nurses said to Sacks, "Watch Jimmy in chapel and judge for yourself." Sacks writes, "I did, and I was moved, profoundly moved and impressed, because I saw here an intensity and steadfastness of attention and concentration that I had never seen before in him or conceived him capable of. Fully, intensely, quietly, in the quietude of absolute concentration and attention, he entered and partook of the Holy Communion. He was wholly held, absorbed by a feeling. There was no forgetting, no Korsakoff's sense, nor did it seem possible or imaginable that there should be." Swinton remarks, "Intensity and power of that unique and special moment was the transformative force that held him, made his life hopeful, and changed the perspectives of those who knew him, Jimmy, from hopelessness to hopefulness. This change of perspective allowed others to hold Jimmy down." The author says also, "At the heart of God's intimate knowing of human beings lies God's remembering of us." In Psalm 8:4, the psalmist asks the wistful question, what it is to be a human being. "What is man that you are mindful of him? The son of man that you care for him?" The adjective mindful here is the Hebrew word zidik. Derives from the verb remember. God is mindful of human beings. To be human is to be held in the memory of God. God watches over human beings, knows them intimately, and remembers them. And all of this, as one says, helps us to get a clearer understanding of what human identity might look like and how it might be sustained even in the most severe dementia. We are who we are because God remembers us and holds us in who we are. We are who we are now, and we will be who we will be in the future because God continues to remember us. Theologically, our identity relates to the me that God sees and remembers. Finally, memory is thus seen to be both internal and external. And he gives the example of the woman that used her BlackBerry, and she found she had to rely on her BlackBerry because she forgot things, like many of us have these other date books or whatever. Some of memory is held by the individual. Some of it is held by her community. All of it is held by God. When some things about ourselves are far from clear in our own minds, we are able to experience a sense of self through the memories of us, but held by those around us, through the stories they tell about us. Memory, like mind and personhood, is corporate through and through. The church, then, is called to become an attentive community of memory and hope that understands what it means to remember people with dementia,